today, but it's just the tip of the iceberg. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And as it's Friday afternoon, I have Tarek Brooker with me. Hi, Tarek. How are you going?
Yeah, pretty good, Martin. Yourself?
I'm sitting there enjoying the ride and thinking, well, you know, there's always plenty to talk about, isn't there?
Well, you know, it all started way back in 2019 when we talked about things and we said, may you live in interesting times. And, well, they've certainly been interesting since, haven't they?
Yeah, so what's interesting, of course, is that there's been so much happening and it's sort of event on event on event. But I think what people have missed quite often, Tarek, is that they're seeing the tips of the icebergs, you know, but there's a whole sort of load of stuff below the waterline that really is the root cause of the issue. And what we're actually still doing is we're seeing a lot of symptoms rather than the real underlying issues that we know are there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, since the financial crisis, we've just been papering over every little issue that we can find and just trying to kick the can down the road. But as you say, you know, to use the iceberg analogy, every time we do that, the iceberg underneath the water that we can't see just keeps getting larger and larger and larger. And then every now and then something will break and we'll get a bit of a preview of what could happen. And it's just so incredibly dire. And I talked about it on Twitter a few days ago, and I compared it to basically, you know, every time there's a new crisis, it's like playing Russian roulette with a bigger and bigger gun and more bullets in the chamber. And eventually, you know, it's not just going to be click, it's going to be bang. And, you know, whether this is the time, you know, the luck's run out and they can't kick the can anymore, we'll just have to see.
Well, the other analogy I'd use is that the old central banks keep putting their finger down the barrel to try and stop it, right? But the question is, if the bazooka gets bigger, you need a bigger finger.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, it depends, you know, if the world runs on Looney Tunes logic or not, because if not, you know, eventually it's just not going to work anymore. And I think that we're starting to see some of that potentially now with, you know, what you'd probably call every man for himself central banking. You know, they're all trying to drive down inflation and address their own domestic issues. And it's just like, if other people blow up, then so be it.
Well, it makes an interesting question because, of course, the Bank for International Settlements, the central banker's banker, is, you know, quite often seen as the archetype of what's actually driving a lot of activity. But you're right. I think that sort of centralized top-down approach is falling apart now. And as you say, central banks are just running for their own exits and trying to solve their own particular problems. You know, Federal Reserve, we've got really big inflation. Never mind what happens to the US dollar, we need to put the rates up. Whereas in the UK, of course, the political party in power could see that they were going to implode over the next couple of years. So they brought in the new prime minister, who's now cooked up a very right-wing, you know, trickle-down model. Well, at least we'll try this and give that a go. You know, it might fail, it might not. And of course, then the Bank of England said, hang on a moment, you know, this doesn't look too good. And the markets say, you've got to be kidding. So, yeah, it really is. I would say to you that the script writers have turned a new page and have decided to up the ante.
Well, unfortunately, you know, we've traded one very good Liz, who was a fantastic leader for a long time, for one that isn't so great, unfortunately. And it's really just a joke. I mean, it's not like the people opposing these particular policies are left-wing or even centrist. There are some heavily right-wing people going, what are you doing? These are unfunded tax cuts, and you've just committed to a basically unlimited policy of subsidizing energy bills over the winter and into 2023. And it's ridiculous. But, you know, you know, I like I said on Twitter the other day, it's in a way, it's fantastic because it shows the rest of the world not what not to do. It's not so great for the people in Britain.
No, well, that's right. I mean, the whole notion of the Laffer curve and just making tax cuts into trickle down, you know, that's failed over the last 30-odd years. And, of course, there were no figures to support these high-level, you know, thought bubbles from the Chancellor in the UK. And they're not going to know anymore in terms of the modelling for a couple of months. I don't know whether you heard, but Liz Truss was actually on local radio yesterday in the UK. And about 12 or 13 different local radio stations had 5 minutes to ask her questions about her policies, right? And every time she reverted back to, but we're actually helping you with your energy bills, because she couldn't answer the broader questions, the fundamental economic questions, which, you know, everybody who's got any sense of history would say, well, hang on a moment, this can't work. But here you are. And, you know, unfortunately, of course, the UK being one of the major economies and very much part of the financial system, the thing that people don't understand is the collateral damage, not just to the UK, but around the world. That's the real risk. And that's what we saw with the bond markets. You know, the £1 trillion, you know, bond, long-term bond market in the UK is connected to the global $26 trillion bond market. So that's the problem. You can't do this in isolation, because the financial system is all connected, like it's below the waterline.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think that's really an interesting point, just to compare and contrast things historically, because everything is interconnected, because we have all these benchmarks constantly being reassessed against each other. It is really, in a lot of ways, one entity, and you can have contagion spread so easily from one thing into another, into another, into another. You know, like, for example, just, you know, those into the reports about the pension funds in the UK, which are very nearly blew up. You know, there were some reports in the UK's Financial Times talking about how they were basically hours away from a, you know, not quite a Lehman Brothers moment, but something, you know, not too far away from that ballpark. And There is no plan B. You know, if you kick off a contagion like that, it will spread and there will be problems. And I just think that relative to other points in history, when you could just go, it's okay, well, we're just going to turn around and use someone else's system. You can't. That's it. You blow up this system. You know, that's, you know, it's a collapse of Rome moment, and someone better step up. Otherwise, you head off into the dark ages.
Well, there's a couple of other quick points on that. Of course, the reason that the pension funds are in so much difficulty is because they actually have a leveraged position. So in other words, they don't actually just invest their own funds once over. What they've done is they've actually multiplied their effectiveness by effectively using margin calls and leverage. And that's the problem, because, of course, the value of the long-term bonds dropped in some cases by half over a couple of weeks, right? And so they kept having to get more and more margin calls. And the only way they can get margin calls is to sell more of those bonds, because that's the highest quality assets they hold. So they were in this doom loop. And that's why the runway was so short. Plus, of course, there were other speculators taking huge positions in the context of what was going on. And that's the other thing that I think, again, people don't understand. The multiplier effect of all the derivatives that we have, again, create huge movements and huge opportunities for losses and gains. And I'm sure there are a number of speculators and hedge funds that have actually made a huge amount of money through these massive moves. And again, it goes to that point of, this is below the waterline. This is not fully understood nor seen. And yet it is actually another fundamental issue that is explaining why we've got so much volatility and why we've got so many parties pulling in different directions. And once again, I come back to this fundamental question. What is the financial system for exactly? Seems to me it should not be about maximizing the gambling profits from those financial entities. It should be actually about providing finance for businesses and households to do the things that households and businesses should be doing. But hey, maybe I'm just old-fashioned.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's all a bit shades of 2008, really, you know, like, you know, leverage bets in the bond market, all this sort of thing. It's just, you know, when you think about, you know, your pension funds, you know, you think that it's going to be invested conservatively, that it's going to be something, you know, particularly people, you know, towards the latter parts of their working life. But you find out about crap like this. And the thing that gets me as well is that rather than acting as a lender of last resort and helping out these pension funds with loans for margin calls, yep, they've got enough stuff that we're not going to do our traditional role. We're going to jump in and we're going to do QE and distort the crap out of the market, not only for the British bond market, but for the global bond market, and then spark a rally that, well, you know, I can imagine, to once again go back to what you were talking about, that quite a few hedge funds made quite a lot of money off.
I know for a fact that some did, exactly. And of course, they're still, the Bank of England is still saying, but we will still do the quantitative tightening just end of October. So hang on a moment. You're quantitative easing over here and you're quantitative tightening over there. And you've got the government, whose basis saying, I'm going to throw lots of liquidity in and go for growth. And you've got the Bank of England saying, oh, well, actually, you know, that could cause a problem. We have to put interest rates up. You've got all these contentions, and it, you know, that's why this is just, it is an amazing time to be covering all of this. And the degree of uncertainty and the degree of cross currents are pretty amazing. And, you know, it does feel a little bit 2006, 2007 to me. I think we've got more surprises just around the corner.
Well, it certainly feels that way. I mean, I like to call what they're doing burnout economics. They've got one foot on the accelerator, another foot on the brake, and all they're getting is a whole lot of noise, a whole lot of smoke, and no real forward momentum. And that's true not only in Britain, but it's also true in continental Europe, with where the ECB is aggressively raising interest rates, but it's also heavily pursuing QE to stop the EU bond market from imploding. So it's happening, you know, all over the show. You know, I mean, it's even, say, like in the US, you've got Biden forgiving student debt to the tune of billions and billions of dollars, which is obviously going to add to inflationary pressures, at least somewhat. And then you've got the Fed aggressively raising interest rates at the most rapid relative pace in history. So, you know, they just can't make up their minds.
And interestingly, I know that the Federal Reserve is calling, you know, all this quantitative tightening coming. But if you look at the Fed balance sheet, it's hardly dropped at all so far. And I think that's something else that's just interesting to look at. So they've changed some of the mixture of the different types of assets they hold, but the absolute level of the Fed balance sheet is still up there. So, yeah, there's some really weird stuff going on.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, part of that's due to when, you know, mortgage-backed security purchases are settled, because they, you know, say something is bought, it's not actually settled in some cases for several months until several months later. So, you know, that has caused the Fed's balance sheet to continue to balloon in some ways when it was meant to be tightening more rapidly. But what's interesting is that we are now coming to the end of those distortions, and you're going to start to see the balance sheet come down more rapidly, which could in turn lead to more greater volatility and potentially more downside in markets.
Exactly. Well, I've said several times the bond market is actually leading the way in many ways, and I think we shall have to keep a close eye. But we should keep a close eye on your slides and the clock, otherwise we'll never get to them. So,
okay. Well, as usual, people, the slides are available at avidcom.substack.com. And a big thank you to everyone who's subscribed and supported me. It is all very much appreciated. Helps keep the lights on while I'm doing all this other sort of stuff. So we'll get right into it. Considering the fact that it's the end of the month, I thought it'd be good to do our update on Aussie housing prices. And I think one of the things that's the most interesting about this chart is the weakest New Zealand market, which is Wellington, which is the weakest non-dotted line here on this chart, is now performing better than most Australian markets to a fairly reasonable degree, with the exception of Perth and Adelaide. If you look at where Sydney is, it's in a completely different world. But the thing I find the most interesting about this is that as of today, Wellington housing prices are down 20% from their peaks. So we are in a much, much worse position than the Kiwis were at this point in their rate rise cycle.
Yeah, very important to understand that. And interesting, of course, the credit numbers came out today from APRA and the RBA, and it showed that the rate of growth in terms of credit for housing is continuing to fall, and falling quite quickly and accelerating. So, and remember that those numbers would have been for August. So expect to see that. And by the way, the ABS data yesterday, I think it was, published the wealth data. And at the end of June, the wealth value of housing had dropped, the wealth value of shares and superannuation had all dropped. The one thing that hadn't dropped was credit. So credit is still rising while the assets are falling. Nothing could possibly go wrong, could it?
No, not at all. I'm sure that we're not going to see, you know, more of a tightening, and not only that, but just more people not choosing to transact in this environment, because FOMO in a lot of ways, in a lot of markets, just isn't there anymore.
No, exactly. Well, it is very much driven by psychology as well as just pure economics. And there's some important points there, I think, of the way things are shifting. And of course, the Roy Morgan data this week showed confidence is still very low, up very slightly, but still very low. you know, historically in recessionary territory.
Indeed. Now, I asked this question on Twitter earlier this week, and basically towards the end of 1968, interest rates in Australia took off. They were at formerly around about 5.4%, and they were roughly in that range for most of the 1960s. And unfortunately, the data I have only goes back to 1959, but during that time, they hovered around about that sort of point, sometimes lower, but never really higher. But from the end of 1968 onwards, they took off. And it would be 48 years before they came back to that same level again. So I think it's interesting to wonder, are we in the midst of something similar in Australia? Was the RBA funding, you know, with the TFF and everything else and COVID, was that our moment where rates were the lowest that they're going to be for decades and decades to come? And to be honest, I don't know, but I think it's a question well and truly worth asking.
Well, I think it's certainly true that the trajectory of rates now has changed, you know, because effectively the policy was quantitative easing and taking rates ultra low. They were already doing that before COVID. You know, the growth level was quite low, of course, and all of those things. That's really now changed. And I agree with you. I think it's quite likely that rates are now going to be higher and going on higher. And just worth thinking about this in one way. The average long-term mortgage rate in Australia, all right, is somewhere between 6 and 7% if you go back, say, 100 years, right? That's typically what people have been used to paying. So we were in an environment over the last 20 years where mortgage rates have been driven lower and lower and lower to places that you wouldn't ever expect them to go. And that, of course, bolstered affordability. That's why people could borrow much more and essentially push house prices up. The link between house prices and credit availability is so strong. If rates are going to go up and your borrowing power reduces, house prices fall. That's why that earlier chart was so relevant, because we know that interest rates are now going up, house prices fall. And because of the leveraged situation that many people have in Australia, their ability to cope with that is supremely limited. That means if rates are going to go higher and stay higher, prices are going to fall. They're going to fall fast and they're going to stay lower.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's sort of, you know, the basic, you know, fundamental, you know, tipping in one direction or another. And I think one thing that's interesting and worth noting about this chart is that you look at interest rates during the 60s, even to a lesser extent in the 1970s. Those rates did not send housing prices to the moon. You know, a 7% rate in the 70s did not send housing prices rocketing. They were still 2 to 3 times household income, in some cases a little bit less. Yet now, even though we're heading for very, very similar mortgage rates, our housing prices are, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10, 14 times household income in some areas. And I think it just speaks volumes about how much the availability of credit has changed, how credit, you know, and the thing that I think is really interesting is people go, well, if you do that, then people aren't going to be able to get houses because credit will be too tight. Well, why is our home ownership rate now a lot lower than what it was in the 1960s or the 1970s, where credit was a lot tighter? It doesn't make any sense. It's like, well, we have these settings that worked, that achieved the highest home ownership rates in Australian history. Why don't we just use those again?
Well, there's two observations. First, of course, the deregulation of the financial system happened, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. That included, of course, the introduction of non-bank lending and securitization, which enabled effectively capital to be recycled more effectively, which effectively enabled the banks to make more profit off the mortgage. And the other thing, of course, is that our regulators got weaker and weaker in their ability to be able to regulate the banks. And if you remember, APRA a few years ago had this sort of 7%, you know, sort of guidance, and then it went down to, well, 2.5% over the current mortgage rate. And now, well, we'll put it up to 3, right? Now, let's just think about that, right? So the mortgage rate then was 2%. So the buffer was effectively at, let's say, 3%, so 5%. Now we've got a mortgage rate 2% higher. That means that the buffer is now up 2%. That means that people, by definition, can borrow less. And that means they can't actually leverage themselves up so much. But we've got a long way back to get anywhere close to 2 to 3 times income, right? I mean, that would you'd need property prices to come way, way down. And, you know, people would have to borrow a lot less to be able to buy property. The question is, will you get back to that? I'm not sure. But this one-way street that we've created is going to create huge pressure. What about those people who've already got those big mortgages and sitting on high home prices and moving potentially into negative equity? And what about those who are trying to get into the market? And, of course, the Productivity Commission report that came out today basically said it's broken.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, you look at the amount of time that it takes to save for a deposit. You know, you're talking now on average, well over a decade. You know, if you go back to say like a 1970s, 1960s example, even in some cases the 1980s, a couple of, you know, if you lived at home, you had a good job, you lived at home with the missus, you know, with your parents, you save for 4 or 5 years, you could just go out and buy an entire house. Yes. You know, yes. Nowadays that's your deposit. That's what I think is a bit ridiculous. You know, like we've reached this, say like in Sydney, if you want a 20% deposit on a house, you say, go buy, say Domain's housing prices about sort of 1.3, 1.4. So you need somewhere between, what's that? $260,000 and $280,000. Okay, that'll take
well,
a couple of years.
Typical average mortgage, right? Average income.
Yeah, well, exactly. So, you know, even if you work your ass off for a couple of years, congratulations. You know, before that, it would have been great job. You've bought a house. You've crossed the finish line. Yeah. Now it's like, congratulations. You've got the deposit. You got to the start line.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, the question, of course, is whether the economy can handle that reduction in value and the reduction in credit momentum, bearing in mind that 2/3 of lending from the banks is now for mortgages, right? Yeah, about 20 years, it was 1/3. And the fact of the matter is that most banks hardly do anything else other than lend for housing. So there's a problem there too. So we are in a very interesting situation.
Yeah, it's hard to say a path back to 2 to 3 times household income. I mean, like, you know, maybe if we get like a big US-style crack, well, have to be bigger than the US, maybe an island-style crash, we could sort of get back to 5 to 7, but, you know, in say places like Sydney and Melbourne. But, you know, I mean, even that, if it's a higher rate future, you know, if, you know, we are going to go back to sort of, I mean, even say, for example, Governor Lowe, he talked about the RBA's long-term range for rates being between 2.5 and 3.5%. Yep. So if we use that as like a bit of a guide, you know, you throw in the bank's margins and, you know, all the usual ancillaries, you know, realistically, you're probably going to be looking at mortgage rates north of 5%, you know, 5.5 to 6.5% on yep. average. So that's a far cry from these loans that were being written at, in some cases, sub 2%.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, mortgage rates of 6 to 7% long-term average in Australia. So that would not be out of whack, but that would give a lot of people huge hangovers.
Yeah. Now, there is this narrative going around that basically landlords can keep jacking up rents till kingdom come as long as they're capped, that they're, as long as their costs are rising. Well, no, they can't. Eventually, a limit is reached and you can't get blood from a stone. Renters just cannot physically pay anymore. They will either move in together and you end up with more share houses, which would take us back to where we were historically pre-COVID, or they move home, or they move to a more affordable area. And on the left there, we've got a little bit of a table from SQM Research on asking rents on the Central Coast, where they are now falling. The Central Coast saw some of the largest renting increases since COVID began, because, you know, it was attractive. You could still commute from the Central Coast to Sydney, you know, sort of once or twice a fortnight, but it was somewhere that was more attractive to work from home. And, you know, now that those particular things are fading and the demand is fading and, well, rents are falling. In New Zealand, which is, you know, one of my sort of favorite bellwethers, rents month on month were flat. In Auckland, they've been relatively flat now for about 6 months, because basically people can't afford to pay anymore. In fact, as of this month, they actually come down a little in certain regions. And I think it just speaks volumes that eventually you cannot get any more money from renters. And once landlords are forced to confront that reality down the road, whenever that ends up being, you know, if they're on the central coast, that's already happening. And that other places will eventually follow. But it does beg the question, where is that equilibrium both for the rental market and for that property market as to whether or not that, you know, people will just sell up and just say, well, it's too much.
Yes, and I'll make a quick point here. If you look at the long-term trends on rents, they are much more correlated to income and income growth than they are to house prices.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Why? Obvious, isn't it? Because it's what people can afford to pay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look at the SQM asking rents index for the capital cities, between 2009 and the start of the pandemic, rents grew by only about 12%. Because real household incomes really didn't grow in a lot of ways at all during a solid proportion of that time. Yet because we've seen this uprush in demand, we've seen rents, at least on the SQM's data, rise by 20%, and even by CoreLogic's data, more than 10%. So, you know, it does eventually, you know, run out of gas.
Yes, absolutely. Well, unfortunately, incomes in real terms are not rising. The RBA is projecting that they won't rise until 2024. And of course, the RBA is so accurate on its forward projections of mortgage growth, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, they are the meme. You know, they are the kings. I mean, that when central banks get made fun of, which they do a lot, when they get made fun of for their forecast, that wage growth chart from the RBA always comes out.
Yeah, well, it's an object lesson.
Indeed. Now, on the topic of rents, I made this little chart for an article I wrote at news.com.au on basically how rental inflation isn't really driving the CPI at all at the moment. It's a very, very minor thing. It's contributing roughly 0.1% to the year-on-year number of the CPI. Yet, if you have the CoreLogic or the SQM rents feed in, you see the rental component of the CPI rise to sort of 1970s, 1980s levels. If the SQM number feeds into the CPI, you go to all-time highs by a large margin. And at that point, more than a third of the RBA's 2 to 3% target is being taken up solely by rental inflation, which means, well, good luck getting headline CPI under control.
Right. But of course, part of the issue is that the ABS one claims to be all rents, not just new rents, whereas the CoreLogic one and the SQM one is more about advertised rents, which are by definition new rents.
Yeah.
But those new rents ultimately will flow through, and they've got the same issue in the US as well, haven't they, with their rental. So if you look at the CPI in the US last time around, the rental stuff was starting to hit because there's this backlog of 6 to 12 months between those rental flows and what actually hits the CPI. So there's another reason why CPI is going to be higher ahead.
Exactly. And that's something that Alex Joyner from IFM put this chart together. And basically it shows that eventually these rises that we're seeing from CoreLogic and from SQM will feed into the CPI. It's just a matter of time and how long it takes. But I think that's something that's really, really interesting in all of this, because this means that, you know, we could be seeing that the rental increases that we're seeing now feed into the CPI 18 months from now. So even if the global economy gets hit by a truck, and even if you see other inflationary pressures come down, this could still be keeping inflation high even then because of that lag.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are a few other factors in there as well, like, for example, the gas price, because, of course, the government trumpeted yesterday they've reached an agreement with the gas companies. Well, the agreement on supply, sure, but not on price. It's still a massively high price. So that means that we're going to have a very significant flow of higher priced energy into the Australian market, which means that both households and businesses will be paying a hell of a lot more for their gas and for their electricity, because electricity is priced off the marginal gas price, than many people expected. So I'm not putting this down as an Albanese win at all. I think they've basically just fluffed it.
Yeah. they performed to the level that I've come to expect of an Australian government.
Yeah. Let's just put it that way. That good, huh?
Now, this is actually a good way to lead into into the next one. The ABS a couple of days ago released their latest monthly inflation figure. Now, I should tell you all, take this with a handful of salt. It is still a preliminary indicator. It is not yet ready for, you know, sort of full-on usage. But if we do take it at face value, as many have, the core CPI, which excludes things like fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, and fuel, is still rising. It's 6.2%. So we now have a proper core inflation measure that is almost identical in terms of its level to the one in the US. In the US, it's 6.3%, and ours is 6.2. So this whole idea that Australian inflation isn't as bad, Australian inflation is going to be easier to control. No, it is almost exactly the same level of underlying inflationary pressure. And the difference in Australia is that ours is definitively still accelerating, whereas the Americans, a bit more question about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I looked at this data when it came out yesterday and decided that that was another reason why the RBA is going to be forced to put rates up a lot higher than many people expect. And of course, our own expectations, the RBA's own expectations, is that inflation is going to go higher before it goes lower.
Yeah, indeed. And just to go back to the rents issue, according to this one, rents are only up 2.4% year on year. So that's a fraction of the 10% seen by CoreLogic or the 20% seen by SQM. So, you know, obviously rents are going to be part of core inflation. So you are going to see those pressures continue to rise, even if we do see continued downward pressure on fuel prices. But, you know, with the excise tax cut expiring yesterday, you know, we're going to start to see higher fuel prices, at least, you know, in the short term, based on that extra 22 cents a litre.
Let's play number Wang.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so many people are keen on it. You know, they're just like, oh, but the inflation came down from 7%. Headline inflation came down from 7% in July to 6.8%. It's like, wow, energy prices.
I know. You know? Yeah, forward looking. Well, there's a lot of inputs that I can see going higher. And unfortunately, I'm afraid that inflation is not beaten. And, you know, the other excuse that Phil Loeb comes up with, well, wage growth isn't rising very fast, right? Which actually, compared with the US, is sort of half true. But if you look carefully, there are now pockets of wage growth that are actually quite strong, and it's rising. So I'm afraid that even that cat is out of the bag too.
The thing that gets me about that is that really something to be proud of?
No.
You know, it's like, oh, you know, I've managed to achieve high inflation, but I haven't even managed to achieve wages growth. It'd just be like, great work, idiot. You know, that's not something you should brag about. It's like accidentally burning down your mate's house and going, oh, I put the fire out. You know, it's just... It doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't hold a hose, so it's not my problem. but the interesting thing about that is that if you go back 12 to 18 months, Phil Lowe was arguing for higher wages growth. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah. Changed his tune now a bit.
Well, you know, it's what they do, you know. Okay. It's what they do. Now... As some of you may know, if you follow me on Twitter, I've been collecting used car stock level data for almost 3 years now, which was actually quite nice because it gave me a baseline before COVID. And recently I've seen the fastest uptick in used car stock hitting the market for private sale since I started the series. And if current trends continue, within the next 4 to 6 weeks, we'll actually see more cars on the market now than there were at this time in 2019. So things are really changing in that regard. And, you know, I sort of see this as a bit of a proxy for levels of household stress, because on the other side of the coin, the delivery delays where people are waiting for new cars are still accelerating. They're still getting longer and longer and longer. So this isn't getting right. This isn't, stock levels are not rising because new cars are coming back. we still have that particular problem. This is occurring, in my view, because we are starting to see those pressures on households.
Yeah, absolutely. And my analysis of the SME sector shows that we're now getting to the crunch point with the SMEs who were struggling through COVID, protected by some of those bankruptcy umbrella protections that were in place, and then they've been taken away again. So we're starting to see now mortgagee in possession sales rise in that sector. And of course, sometimes they'll have vehicles as part of their asset pool.
Mm.
And some of those are coming onto the market too. So I was talking to somebody in the car dealing sphere quite recently who said he's seen an uptick in utes. You know? And these are people who were actually working in the construction area or elsewhere, had their own vehicle, and now their business has fallen over, so the ute's up for sale. I think that's another reason why this is happening. And we're also seeing other evidence looking in our surveys of people now starting to look at what else can they sell. You know, what assets have they got in their house that they don't need anymore, the older gym machines and things like that, and the other things that were bought at the height of the, well, I'm bored at home, I need to have something else to do. Suddenly it changed. So I think this is a very important leading indicator, and again it's aligned with some of the stress data, which, by the way, I'm going back to that Central Coast issue. Mortgage stress is very high in the Central Coast, and rental stress is even higher. And in my data that's coming out in a couple of days, I'll show that rental stress in the last couple of months has gone absolutely haywire. It's gone really, really high. So all of those things, I think, are connected.
Yeah. I mean, there was an article in the local paper up in Newcastle recently that someone shared on Twitter that in areas of Newcastle, people are spending over 50% of their gross household income on rent. And that is just an insane number. You know, it's not sustainable in the long term. I mean, look, I get it that people are willing to make sacrifices to live in a place like Los Angeles or New York in a cupboard because of the culture and the opportunities that is provided. Living on the outskirts of Newcastle is not comparable to that. It's not the same. You know, you're not gonna get cast in, you know, the next big Hollywood blockbuster, or, you know, get a job on Wall Street, you know, living, you know, in some house out there. And I'm not knocking the place, but just it's obviously just not comparable in terms of the level of overall demand in the long term.
No, well, it's interesting because I've just updated my models with all the census data, and I now have the net income on average for each household relative to the net payment for rent and the net payment for mortgage. And it's really horrific in some cases just how much people are actually spending of their net disposable income on just paying for somewhere to live. It's astonishingly high. And, the areas around Newcastle and around Wollongong are areas where it's particularly high at the moment.
Oh, it's Aussie innovation right there, mate.
Yeah.
Now, this one I think is interesting because Aussie retail sales surprised to the upside again. They are still growing faster than inflation, at least, you know, at the most sort of basic bar napkin level comparison. And I think that sort of speaks volumes about the K-shaped economy that you and I have talked about, you know, the sort of divergence between, you know, the have and the have not, because the have are still very much spending away, while the have not have already been forced to tighten their belts. So, and considering the backdrop of the fact that we've seen, you know, probably the best part of almost 10 years of real household income growth destroyed already, I think it just goes to show that you know, that particular theory of that divergence is well and truly occurring.
Well, I'm seeing it in my surveys again. So we know that there are about one third of households that are doing fine. They've got lots of buffers. They can handle a 3 or 4% increase on their mortgage if necessary, and they're still able and willing to spend. But there's another third that I've got no hope. And there's a third in the middle sort of struggling with trying to decide what to do. Also make the other point, of course, that retail chart is not inflation adjusted.
No.
And the point is, of course, we're paying a lot more, in some cases, a lot more for some of the basics. Look at food and cost, you know, and vegetables, those sorts of things, and other categories too. So you may have to be spending a bigger dollar amount to buy the same again. And we also know that, looking at my surveys, that some people are changing their patterns of shopping. So they're going to, down market to supermarkets and buying smaller lots of things as well. Others are not. So the K is absolutely there in the middle of all this. And we are creating a very divided society, in my view. You can talk about it in terms of house ownership versus not and all sorts of things. But this is ability to spend and how much you can spend on what do you want to spend on is pretty critical. And it's interesting because if you go back to the UK, part of the thinking from the current government in the UK from an election perspective is there's enough people who actually will benefit from tax cuts because they'll feel more wealthy, enough to vote them back in again. So there is actually a political alignment, unfortunately, talking about how you can help a certain more affluent section of the economy because there could be sufficient to vote you in next time. That is a disaster, in my view.
Yeah, and the thing as well, just to note, is that is even more powerful in the UK and in the US than it is in Australia because they have first past the post voting, which means whichever candidate gets the most votes wins. Whereas here in Australia, we have obviously our preferential voting. Yep. So you still need to win. You still need to win 50% of the electorate's preferences. Where in the UK, you can, with the Lib Dems and the Greens and everybody else and UKIP or whoever is challenging this time, you can get elected into parliament with 29, 30, 35% of the vote.
Well, what proportion of the vote did Albo get?
What primary vote? Oh, I honestly can't remember.
It was in the 30s, I think.
Yeah, it was. It was 37, 38, maybe.
Exactly. Yeah. How good is the PR system?
Well, I guess, it's the best of a bad bunch.
Exactly. Exactly right, isn't it? Democracy, we love it.
Yeah. Well, what do they say? It's the
least worst.
Yeah, the least worst. That's the one. Now, this is the real wages growth issue that I was talking about. Now, this, to me, is why the Fed and all these other central banks are raising interest rates so aggressively, because they want to prevent what happened there on the left. In the real hourly US wages, in terms of purchasing power, peaked in February of 1973, and they didn't recover to that level for 46 years. Now, here in Australia, we've already seen 10 years of wages growth disappear in real terms, and we're probably going to see another 4 years of it disappear, provided the RBA is correct with their wage growth forecast, which is pretty heroic. And I think that is the real crux of the rates issue for me, because if they don't tame inflation, if they don't kill it quickly, it's going to kill more and more real household spending power. And I think it's just worth thinking about that in its, shall we say, its broader context. You can't take away 6, 7, 8, 10% of a household's real spending power and then expect them to spend at the same level that they were before that cut. Eventually, it is going to feed into the economy and it is going to hit real outcomes for businesses, for retailers, for tradies, for everyone. And that is the thing that I feel like is just being just completely overlooked in all of this, because it is going to hit the economy hard eventually.
No, I agree with that as well. And again, my surveys show that there are some people who are fine, as I said, but a lot of people prioritizing quite differently from what they did a couple of years ago. And of course, through COVID, they got the government supports or JobKeeper and things. So they actually were able to keep up their spending patterns. And that's now changed. So spending patterns are quite different. And interestingly, when I ask them about what's ahead, some of them will say, well, hopefully my wages will catch up. So they're still hanging out for this idea that the get out of jail card is going to be wages growth. I'm not sure.
Hopefully it is, but yeah.
I'm just not convinced. And the data from the US shows that, you can go a hell of a long time before real wages growth kicks in. And really, I'm not sure the conditions in Australia are right, even as the RBA would hope over the next 3 or 4 years to see real wages growth, because there are so many other things like the gig economy and all of those things and automation. I mean, I can put up a whole bunch of reasons why it is that actually for many people, wages growth is going to be quite anemic. And of course, the biggest growth sectors in terms of where the growth of employment is. It's in relatively lower paid, caring, you know, health, those sort of areas. They traditionally don't have very high wages and wages growth anyway. So I am not convinced that we're going to see this turning around anytime soon. So the get out of jail card that people are hanging out for may not be there.
The big thing for wages for me is that we had basically 2.5 years of ideal conditions. We had closed borders. We had stimulus to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. And, you know, people driven to spend by psychology, by the pandemic. Yet even under those, the most ideal of conditions, we didn't achieve even what could be considered sort of decent-ish wage growth. And with Albo ramping up immigration to the, you know, permanent immigration to its highest level ever,
yep.
I don't see how that's going to help us achieve this wages growth that Labor spent so much time talking about achieving during the federal election campaign and that they still keep talking about now. And it just, well, it doesn't really make much sense, does it?
It doesn't make a lot of sense. And, of course, the other thing is they're now finding lots of reasons as to why they've got to cut things rather than actually invest in things, because of course the structural deficits and all of those things which you're going to hear about in the budget in the next month. There's a whole bunch of very important questions which I don't think are being adequately discussed here, and the center of gravity is that the levers are not being pulled the right way to drive wages in the right way, in my view. There'll be a lot of talk about it, but very little action, I think.
Yeah, that I think that pretty much sums it up, to be honest, unfortunately. Yeah, it kind of almost speaks for itself, doesn't it? You know,
going down.
So, you know, all $18.5 trillion worth of value wiped off U.S. financial assets, and in you know, since the start of 2022, I think it speaks volumes to me about the current situation we're in. But I think it also says something else. It says that the pivot is stupid, because the thing is, if you pivot, the bond market throws a tantrum and it destroys more wealth. It destroys more value. You know, while you might be able to save the stock market, and it might, at the end of the day, it's going to do damage to the bond market. It's going to do damage to mortgage-backed securities. It's going to do damage to the borrowing costs of corporations, which will eventually undermine the economy. And that's one of the reasons why I don't think we've seen a pivot yet. And I don't think we will see one from the Fed until we start to see something really major break, or the labour market starts to deteriorate significantly.
And or. Yeah, because it goes back to what we said at the start. You know, there's a whole bunch of sort of things below the waterline which are already, I think, bumping up against each other and sort of fracturing. But I have to think that we're going to see further falls in value and further falls in terms of asset prices. And going back to what is the long-term fair value of assets, I mean, if you take stock markets, for example, if you think about future earnings and translate that back to current stock market prices, they're still priced for perfection pretty much even now. There's more downside, I think probably another 20% downside risk on equities, particularly in the US, but I think also here. And with regard to bonds, well, you know, if the bond yields continue to rise, bond prices fall. That's just the way that bonds work. And as rates go higher, of course, the Fed and the other central banks put rates higher, bond rates are going to follow. So, house prices are also falling. So any asset you like to name, crypto, just add that in as well. Why not? Oh, I'll look at gold and silver. Well, they haven't done very well either. There is no hiding place.
No. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this chart is that in some ways it actually quite nicely illustrates the particularly the period between 2008 and 2010, why bonds, you know, and why basically the balance kicks in when you do see one of these hard recessions. Because what's gonna happen if we do have a really, really bad recession is you're gonna see the value of stocks drop. But as the value of stocks drop and as inflation falls, you're going to see the value of bonds rise. So there is that balance overall. So while there's going to be a lot of people howling about the stock market, there's going to be a lot of people doing very, very well in the bond market.
Well, it's interesting because the older theory was go 60-40, 60% equities, 40% bonds, right, because of that countervailing thing. Except if you talk to some experts in the bond market, they'd argue that in recent times the bond market has not been behaving the way it should have, and it hasn't actually been the natural hedge that you normally get because it's not behaving logically either. Now, that may just be a temporary factor, but it may be that this time something else is breaking. We will see. And like we keep saying, there's plenty of opportunity for things to break.
Yeah, well, I mean, if that particular relationship is broken and a recession doesn't bring down bond yields, well, I just say asset prices in general have a problem, whether it's your house, whether it's your stocks, it isn't going to matter. There's going to be problems.
Yeah, well, it goes back to will central banks still ultimately be comfortable to see assets of all value going down? You know, Fed Chair Powell the other week said, we need a house price correction in the U.S., so he's happy to see house prices correct. And he said previously that the markets are overdone, they need to come back. I haven't heard him said specifically about the bond market, so we should listen for that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's what it's all about. I think it's about restoring that level of normality and that relationship for the bond market. But just on Powell, can you imagine if Lowe said that? He'd be burned at the stake. He'd be out there like Joan of Arc in Martin Place by the end of the day, and Albo would have replaced him with, I don't know, some property spruiker.
I know. Yeah, well, it would be a property spruiker because 9 out of 10 people in Australia appear to be property spruikers. So,
all right, let's get on to the next chart before we find ourselves in trouble. This is just basically a tweet from a journalist in the UK, just that we were sort of, you know, this close to the insolvencies of, you know, mass numbers of UK pension funds.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing about that, as I tweeted the other day, was, you know, this could be a Lehman moment. We were very close. We were a lot closer than many people realised at the time. A point I'd make, Tarek, is it's not solved yet. No. Remember that these purchases that the Bank of England is doing is until the end of October, right? And they're spending, well, the last couple of days, they spent $1 billion. They were prepared to spend up to $5 billion a day, which means that they could be spending £60 billion to try and actually prop up the pension sector in the UK. That's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. And as you say, these issues haven't been solved. And to be completely honest with you, I think they've gone about it in completely the wrong way. You know, I mean, they didn't act as lender of last resort. And so they just started throwing cash at the bond market instead. Yep. And yeah, I think it was a completely unneeded distortion. I mean, you've got people like the Fed and others saying, oh, you know, we understand. I don't buy that. I reckon they're just saying that because, I mean, you can't have the what exactly are they supposed to say when an interviewer says, well, what do you think of the Bank of England? I thought it was absolutely insanely stupid. Yes. You know, it's just, and we've now blown up markets.
Yeah. Well, they won't say that because, of course, they're all in the same club, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, they're in the same boat too, to varying degrees.
Exactly.
Okay, now this is something that's sort of prompted a little bit of controversy: the damage to the Nord Stream gas pipelines that run from Russia into Germany. And there is some speculation from within the German government that they could be unusable, that the corrosion that may occur inside the pipeline could basically take it out of action permanently. Now, I should stress that no actual assessment of the damage has been done yet at a sort of looking at it closely level. It's mostly just speculation and sort of very, very broad assessment. So, but if that is the case, well, the Europeans have got some problems. And so do the Russians, for that matter.
I blame the dolphins.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. This is just the first part of their plan for world conquest, you know?
Exactly.
First address climate change through blowing up gas pipelines, you know, then there's phase two.
Exactly.
So long and thanks for all the fish.
Exactly, exactly. It's yeah, Douglas Haglund's. He knew a thing or two.
Yeah, he certainly did. This basically shows that Nord Stream was one of the major sources of gas into Europe prior to it being first taken offline for maintenance in July, and then the Russians cutting off the gas in August because reasons, and, you know, claims of issues with equipment, etc., because of sanctions. But I think it sort of just illustrates nicely just the level of reliance Europe does have on Nord Stream, because it's going to be a real pain in the ass to refill their gas stores for winter without Nord Stream next year.
Well, it'd be almost impossible to do it. You know, they're working hard on bringing in LNG and, you know, creating temporary terminals and pumping some of the gas up from Spain up through into Europe. But it's a major issue. And of course, if we have a cold winter, then it's going to put huge pressure on the Eurozone. They're already forecasting potential recession. Well, it could, you know, be huge. And the latest data is not good too. So it shows you just how cutting this is to the heart of the economic activity in the whole of Europe that this thing is.
Indeed, and that's actually on the next chart, that basically they are reliant on luck.
Yep.
Literally, there's this chart from Bloomberg shows, it's like, this is what happens if we're lucky, this is what happens if we're not lucky. Yep. So, you know, I think that there are some, you know, fairly sort of, you know, serious issues for there for Europe. And there have been some who've made the point that we could see some European nations break with the Eurozone and break with NATO on their stance on Ukraine in exchange for getting the gas turned back on. Because there are other pipelines into places like Southern Europe, particularly into Italy, where there's sort of now this idea that this new right-wing government could make a deal with Putin to turn the gas back on, because Italy is more reliant on gas than most of Europe, and, well, basically just, you know, make a deal.
Yeah, it feels like a chess game to me. You know, they keep moving pieces and see what happens, and they move another one and move another one. I guess the question is there somebody over the top thinking there is a master plan here, or is it just action, reaction, action, reaction? I'm not sure. It's difficult to know.
I just feel like it's all a bit muddled, to be honest. Like, it's just, you know, never attribute to malice what could equally be true, attributed to stupidity. And, you know, like, I think we've seen that, well, unfortunately,
stupidity.
Well, it's contagious, apparently. You know, I mean, I really do wonder what's going to happen. I mean, like, even say, like, with the Germans, you know, they've now decided that they're going to follow the Liz Truss approach when it comes to energy, and they're going to subsidize it to the tune of 200 billion euros. And, you know, I don't know. To me, it should have been something that should have been targeted. You know, there needs to be a better plan in terms of actually cutting the level of gas consumption.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know.
Well, there was a book just came out called 200 Years of Muddling Through. Right. I think that's a brilliant title for a book, and it so much sums up so much.
Yeah, it really does. Unfortunately, I'd love that to be wrong, but here we are.
Yeah.
US capital goods still surprising to the upside once you strip out things like defense and aircraft, which obviously distort the data very, very badly. And I think that this just goes to show that while things are rolling over slowly, they're rolling over slowly. It's not happening really, really quickly. And, you know, this idea that the Fed is going to immediately kill the US economy with rising rates just doesn't hold water.
No, that's right. The truth is, of course, that the Fed is struggling with an economy that's still in parts very strong. One of the reasons why inflation is still sticky and embedded. And of course, the joblists and the numbers are very low. I think we might come onto that in a moment or two. So they've got this dilemma. How high do they go to try and actually crush inflation? Well, higher than many people think. And for longer. So higher for longer is the new mantra. And in fact, a number of the senior Fed people over the last week have been speaking about precisely that, higher for longer, higher for longer. I think the message is now quite clear, higher for longer.
Well, if some of those Fed speakers are correct, and we are talking about sort of like a terminal federal funds rate, which is their version of the cash rate, of about 5%, all I can say is good luck to the rest of the world. Good luck to the RBA, because, you know, all these ideas of, you know, 2.85, 3%, if they're running at 5, not going to happen.
And think about the impact on the US dollar vis-a-vis other exchange rates. Yeah. And we've already seen the US dollar massively high. It came back a little bit in the last couple of days, but still very high. You know, the Aussie dollar is being pushed down. That means that we import more inflation. That's going to put more inflationary pressure on us and on many other economies too. And it's interesting because one of the Fed people the other day said, we will make policy decisions based on what's good for the US, right? Which is sort of understandable, but it also means hang everybody else, which is where we came into the conversation earlier on, you know, central banks doing their own thing.
Yeah, every man for himself.
Exactly.
All right, last chart for today. And basically, the number of people claiming initial claims for US unemployment benefits have continued to trend down. And, you know, this is really annoying a lot of people, actually, because they've been saying, oh, the Fed needs to pivot. Everyone needs to stop raising rates. But, well, the US labor market is still extremely strong. Admittedly, it is a backward-looking indicator, but it's also one of the Fed's key indicators.
Absolutely. And this whole idea of the Fed pivot, you know, it's been one of those things that a lot of market analysts have been begging for and talking about and talking it up and talking it up. The reason they're talking it up, Tarek, is quite simple, right? They need the markets to go higher, and they'll say anything and do anything to try and get the markets to go higher. The truth is that the Fed is now very clearly on its tightening cycle. The indicators in the US are still quite strong, the labor one and some other ones we can look at there. And so there are really no reasons why they wouldn't go on lifting and quite a lot higher for a lot longer. And a lot of people in the financial system, who are particularly the advisors and investment managers, you know, they're all getting a little worried because they think, oh, shit, that means that markets are going to drop even further. And I just remind you, September, October is the time in the year when the markets tend to behave the worst. And I've said this, you know, in the last few weeks, September, October is time to watch. And in fact, as you go into October, expect those markets to drop a lot further. More people, I think, will be shocked by just how volatile the markets will be in the time ahead. But that won't stop the Fed.
No. No, I mean, the Kashgari basically had, you know, a barbecue and a party to, you know, talk about the fact that the market has dropped. You know, when it dropped back down to what was around about 30, when the S&P 500 dropped down to about 3,600 back in June, he was like, this is fantastic. You know, and that's not really something you expect from a central banker, but they are happy. They want financial conditions to tighten. They want the market to fall. I mean, they even want the housing market to fall.
Yep.
And I just think that it just speaks volumes about where we're at in that regard. I mean, you've got, you know, Ray Dalio says down 20%. Druckenmiller came out yesterday and he said, I reckon that stocks are basically not going to rise for another decade. Mm. You know, I mean, you know, these are some fairly sort of substantial people saying these things. And realistically, looking at the data without some form of Fed intervention, they're not wrong. I mean, no. I don't know about Druckenmiller's prediction of 10 years. Obviously, that's far too long for me to be predicting anything. But, like, you know, just solely based on where we're at, about 18 times earnings on the S&P 500. You know, if you extrapolate the bear market average for the S&P, that means you've probably got another 20, 25, 30% to go.
Yep.
To reach the average PE. And not only that, but then you've got the E part of PE, which for those who may not know stands for earnings. And well, they're sure as hell not going to hold up if the economy deteriorates.
No, well, that's what I said earlier on about the earnings. You know, the price earnings ratios are way off still. They're still well overvalued, still priced for perfection. So another 20% down is certainly quite feasible. And I guess the other point that's worth underscoring, going back to the Bank of England, you know, what they did with their intervention to save the pension was a qualitatively different type of quantitative easing than previously, right? It was designed for a particular purpose, and they say it's going to be short term. Now, we may see some of those sorts of behaviours, but they are not talking about cutting interest rates. They're still talking about lifting interest rates in the UK, even with the quantitative easing they're now doing to save the pension sector. And in fact, in the UK, they're talking maybe a 100 basis points next time to try and get interest rates up. So the expectation has to be that central banks are going to drive interest rates a lot higher for a lot longer. And that's going to put huge, huge pressure on asset prices, we've discussed, on earnings, and of course, on wages. So I'm afraid that this is you know, the landscape we're in. And again, it's all below the waterline at the moment. But from time to time, we'll see in a few icebergs roll over and pop up. I think that's going to go on for a few more months, muddling through.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point, because ultimately what central banks want to do is to maintain the sanctity of the bond market, of that particular thing above all else, and also the sort of solvency of their sovereigns. You know, to basically make sure that governments can continue to service their debts. Now, generally speaking, that's viewed through the lens of, well, we need lower yields. But I would say, and we actually talked about this last year, and a few people thought we were idiots, but anyway, we were right. What if the answer isn't lower interest rates? What if the answer is actually higher interest rates, but more QE?
Yep.
What if it's constant burnout economics, one foot on the accelerator, one foot on the brake? We're designed to save the sovereign, save the bond market, but all the other asset prices can burn in order for us to save what we need to. And I think that's a scenario that's well and truly worth exploring.
I agree with you. And all the evidence that I've seen in the last few months is that's precisely how the thinking is playing out. So we might well get bouts of QT, but we'll also get bouts of QE in particular areas. But I think the era of ultra-low interest rates has certainly passed for at least a decade or two, because I think they won't go there again.
Yeah, well, I think in a lot of ways it's going to be like, what do they say, fighting the last war. Mm. You know, like what we saw as a response to COVID and even initially to inflation was them fighting the last war, was them continuing with QE, continuing to think that no, inflation's not possible, it's all going to be transitory, everything's going to be fine. But I think you're right, because unless we see a massive shift in inflation and the underlying things that helped cause it, they're going to be fighting the next war 5, 10, 15 years from now when the next crisis comes along, and they're going to be like, well, you know what, this time we need to be careful. This time we don't want to cause inflation. They probably won't do enough.
Yeah.
Next time, because they did too much this time, but that's usually what they do.
Yeah. And it takes a long time for them to make their decisions because of all the leads and lags and everything else, and nothing's going to happen quickly. But just reflect on this as we sort of close out. There was a talk, quite a lot of talk about negative interest rates and needing to take rates into negative territory to drive inflation up, right? Funny how that's all gone away now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it would really be something now for the RBA to kick off talk of negative interest rates. But hey, you know, I mean, maybe they'll try and save the housing market. Maybe they'll just be like, you know, well, we don't care about inflation. We don't care about the economy. We only care about nominal housing prices.
Well, APRA's still planning for negative interest rates, so watch this space. Tarek, very important conversation today. So much to talk about. Oh, I think we've done a reasonable job, even if it's gone on a bit. But thanks for your slides, as always, and we'll do it again in a couple of weeks, hey?
Yeah, definitely, mate. I'm sure there'll be more to talk about.
I'm sure. See you. Take care.
See you, mate. Bye.